From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. Today, I'm glad to welcome Andy Rothman to the show. Andy is an investment strategist at Matthews Asia, where he's principally responsible for developing research focused on China's ongoing economic and political developments. Andy started his career in the U.S. Foreign Service. He spent close to two decades working on China. This included serving as the head of the econ section at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing in the late 90s. During a critical period in U.S.-China negotiations over China's entry into the WTO. It's also, in fact, when we first met in 1998, when I was posted out here studying Chinese. Prior to joining Matthews Asia in 2014, Andy spent 14 years as the chief China strategist at CLSA Brokerage and Investment Group. Altogether, Andy has lived and worked in China for more than 20 years. And in my view, is one of America's smartest observers of political economic issues related to China and U.S.-China trade and economic issues. Andy, thanks for joining the podcast this morning.
Good to be here. Thanks.
There's a lot of debate about engagement with China. You have been a firsthand participant in that period of engagement in the capacities that I just mentioned, also in China's transformation into an economic and political power. And I think given that, you can speak much more clearly to whether or not this strategy and engagement was a failure, was it effective? What were there positive benefits of engagement? What's your views on this ongoing debate about engagement?
That's a great way to start the conversation about U.S.-China policy right now, because I think one of the biggest problems right now is this misperception that 40 years of engagement between the U.S. and China has been a complete failure, that it's failed to produce any benefits for America. And therefore, for the next 40 years, why bother with engagement? Mm-hmm. Let's just go hide in our corner and send China off into their corner. And I think it's a mistake, because I think engagement, while far from perfect, has been pretty successful. Let me just give you a few examples. Since China joined the WTO almost 20 years ago, U.S. exports to China are up over 500%. To the rest of the world, they're up about 100%. Now, for sure, China has not lived up to or implemented all of its commitments, but they've implemented enough commitments that GM, for example, is selling more cars every year in China than they are in the United States, that Intel gets about a quarter of its global revenue from China. Engagement with China has been great for American consumers, keeping prices low, especially for lower income families who spend a higher share of their disposable income on tradable goods. It's been good for most Chinese people, not all, but most Chinese people have a much freer, less repressive life today than they did 20 years ago. And that should be important to us. So I think that while there have been problems, engagement's worked pretty well.
You've also mentioned U.S. exports. And also I want to ask you about, you mentioned China in this. I mean, you came to China for the first time in 1980, I believe.
That's right.
And, you know, there's a lot, in this debate, there's a lot of folks who say, you know, China hasn't sort of opened up politically, opened up economically like we thought they would. How do you see that issue?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I have a lot of sympathy for empathy for people who just started looking at China maybe 10 years ago and who are saying, hey, it hasn't changed all that much. But I look at it back from having first come as a student in 1980, started working in Guangzhou in 1984 at the American Consulate, and it's a night and day change for the everyday life of Chinese people, and also for the benefits that it's brought to us. We wouldn't be having this conversation over the electronics we're using right now without having China as part of the supply chain, I think. So we need to be somewhat realistic, and we also have to understand what the objectives were of engagement. I don't believe, when I look back over my participation in this or reading the history of the more senior people who were involved, that engagement with China was designed to generate a fundamental change to the structure of the Chinese governance system or the Chinese economy. It was designed to open up markets for American companies, and it was designed to improve China's behavior abroad. And I think on both of those counts, it's worked pretty well. Not perfect. We can point to disputes in the East and South China Sea, for example. But overall, China is not a strategic threat to the United States today.
And I think the one figure you mentioned on the U.S. exports has gone up 500% to China. And as you indicate, U.S. companies, quite a bit of their focus and strategy is in China because of the growing market here. It's safe to say that there's a lot of folks in the Trump administration that don't share your view on this engagement.
I've heard that.
And the concept on the other end of the spectrum that is put forward by a number of Trump officials is this idea of decoupling. Could you give us a sense, your perspective on this issue of decoupling? Is it feasible? What would the implications of such a shift be for the United States?
In my view, decoupling from China is impossible for a couple of reasons. One is we're too coupled already. Mm-hmm. This is not the Cold War era Soviet Union relationship where the Soviets played no discernible role in the global economy and certainly not in our economy. We are already heavily integrated with the Chinese economy. So how do you decouple from that without wrecking the house, our own house?
It's a bit like unscrambling an omelet.
Yeah. And what would the benefits of that be? And what do we say to GM or its workers in the U.S. or the pension funds that hold their shares that your biggest market in the world is going away? Or Boeing. They sell more airplanes in China than they do in any other market, including the United States. What happens to all of our tech companies that get a significant share of their global revenue from China? Plus, in the Cold War era, we had a lot of allies. How many countries are going to go along with this decoupling? Are we going to be asking our allies and partners around the world, you have to choose. You're either going to have an exclusive relationship with us or with China. Is that a choice we want to put forward to our partners? And let's also think about it from an economics perspective. Every year on average for the last decade, China has accounted for 1/3 of global economic growth. That's a larger share of global growth than from the US, Europe, and Japan combined. So is this in our interest to pull the rug out from under that economy?
Now, this summer we had a track to in Washington, D.C. We invited Trump officials in, and one White House officials that we invited in said, it's interesting. We're really not hoping to decouple, but China started to decouple first because they wouldn't let Facebook in and they wouldn't let Google in. They wouldn't let Twitter in. How do you see this in that context?
There is no question that the relationship is complicated and has a lot of problems. Nobody can argue that it's perfect or even close to that. The question is, how do we solve those problems? How do we make more progress? And I think a lot of the dynamic about decoupling is based on a false narrative that engagement in the past hasn't worked. It hasn't been productive. And we already talked about that. If you accept the history, and I think the evidence is there, at least in corporate balance sheets on companies like GM and Intel, then you can see that we've made progress. And how do we get more? Should we keep putting pressure on them to let Google and Facebook in? Sure. Should we keep applying pressure on issues that are important to us, like what's happening in Hong Kong? Of course. But think about it this way. If we say to the Chinese government, we're going to challenge you at every turn, we're going to make a deliberate effort to try and stop you from getting richer and stronger, but please cooperate with us, improve your behavior in Hong Kong, is that going to get the results that we want?
So if not decoupling, is there one of the things you hear on the technology side is it will be inevitable that we have some decoupling on the technology side? From a national security perspective. Do you agree with that? And also, if not decoupling, what should the scope of our goals be in this regard?
Well, we have to recognize that we have legitimate and significant security concerns. We always have. But what worries me is that I think a lot of the conversations about these concerns have drifted away from being based on facts and science. I had the opportunity to work on COCOM, which it seems like ancient history now. This was the organization that was created by us after World War II to control exports of dual-use technology to the Soviet Union and China. I did this during the Reagan administration on telecom stuff. And what I found was that when we had science-based evidence of security risks, all of our allies lined up with us. Mm-hmm. The fact that our allies are not lining up with us now makes me feel that we are pushing a political agenda rather than a science-based technology and national security agenda. Mm.
Let me turn to the trade negotiations, and I won't ask you to pull out your crystal ball or be our podcast.
I think I broke
Trump
it on the
whisperer.
Way over to China.
let me start by asking it this way. Many Americans, Republicans and Democrats, even those that don't agree with Trump's tariffs or his art of the deal tactics in the negotiations or his tweets, even the strongest opponents in many cases of Donald Trump will say, on the trade and economic issues, he's fighting the right fight. And so, and that fight is that China has not been playing fair, they've not been playing by the rules, and this is coming at a huge cost to Americans. How do you see this question? Do you see it similarly, or do you have a different view?
I've got a lot of problems with that narrative. First of all, as I said before, I think the engagement process has worked, and we should continue on that. Second of all, the issues that the Trump administration is highlighting with China are not really the most important ones in my view. For example, the president is focused, maybe obsessed, with the size of the bilateral trade deficit. Yeah. It's really hard to find any economist anywhere in the world who believes that that is a sound way to evaluate the relationship. Second, what are we asking the Chinese to do? If we're asking them to open up market access, better protect intellectual property rights for American companies, fine. But are we really in a position to tell them what they should be doing in terms of the fundamental structure of their country, its economy? Shouldn't each country be able to do that on its own? But most importantly, the way to get progress is to work through the global institutions that the United States built after World War II that have created the many decades of prosperity and security. And instead, the Trump administration seems to be tearing those institutions down. So what are we going to be left with? We're left with bilateral negotiations where it seems to be a winner-take-all, burn-down-the-houses kind of approach. And that's not the kind of approach you want to take when you're in a negotiation with someone who's going to be a long-term partner.
So you mentioned market access and IPR and that these are issues that we should be pressing on. In fact, I've heard you argue this week that those are areas, frankly, that are also in China's interest. With greater competition in different sectors, it will create more competitive Chinese companies. And the IPR problem, as you've stated this week, is often between Chinese companies. And so greater IPR protection will be beneficial in China. You make a distinction, though, with this trying to change the structure of China's economy. And I assume you mean by that the more state-led aspect of it, where folks, you know, you priority on SOEs and subsidies. Talk a little bit about that, if you could. And also, are there subsidies that create distortions in the global economy? Is there within that issue of the structure of China's economy, are there legitimate complaints on issues that where China uses subsidies, but it makes our companies less able to compete?
Well, first, a bit of context. And it's important to recognize that the Chinese economy has changed a lot. This is not your grandfather's command and control Chinese economy. When I started working in China, there were no private companies at all. You couldn't even find a privately owned restaurant in China at that time. Today, more than 85% of urban employment in China is with small, privately owned entrepreneurial companies. All of the net new job creation is with these small private companies because the state sector is still shrinking. So the Chinese government has come to the recognition that they need an entrepreneurial market-based economy closer to what ours is, and they're moving there. Maybe not at the pace that we would like, but they're moving in that direction. But I also think that it's not reasonable. We would reject an effort by other countries to tell us, hey, you need to fix your healthcare system because that doesn't work well. We all have our own systems, and we have used industrial policy in the past. Generally, we view industrial policy as something to be avoided. So I think when we look at state-owned enterprises in China, we need to just worry about our own game. Let's make sure our infrastructure is built, our hard infrastructure, our education infrastructure, our tax policies, because if we've determined that state-owned enterprises and industrial policy doesn't work, let's just sit back and let the Chinese sort through that on their own. Mm-hmm. Now, people say it creates distortions, and we have systems in place to deal with that. Now, they're cumbersome, they take a long time, but also put it in perspective. People talk about steel, for example. The Trump administration is very keen on that. Yeah, there's a lot of Chinese government money wasted subsidizing money-losing state-owned steel mills, but last year, China only exported 0.6% of their total steel production, and only a small amount of that came directly to the United States. So my view is, why are we all that worried about that?
So on a final note, I want to ask you, Andy, about the trade deal and what, and I don't want to ask you to predict what might happen, because I think that's hard to predict. But you hear a lot of folks already kind of getting out in front of this. Phase one deal would be mostly about purchases, which will help Donald Trump in his presidential election. So it's mostly kind of political things that Trump needs. It's not so much on the structural issues, the market access and IPR, frankly, which you talked about, although they say there would be some on IPR and financial services openings and potentially currency. So some people are ready to go and say, this is a weak deal, it's a failure. Others are saying it's mostly just purchases, so it's very political, it's not what we need. Phase two and phase three, we won't be able to get the structural issues that we want. How do you think we should be looking at this current stage?
I think that we should be looking at this as any deal is a good deal. I don't know what's going to be in the deal. My assumption is that there will be a deal because I believe that President Trump has already decided that that is in his best interest for his reelection campaign. It looks like there'll be some commitments on agricultural purchases, on better market access, and better protection for IP. These are all things that are good for the Chinese economy as well as for our companies. But even if it's a very limited deal, it's really important because it gets us over this huge obstacle of the looming escalation of a tariff dispute into a full-blown trade war that prevents the two governments from having an adult conversation about what they want the relationship to look like over the coming decades. So whatever the deal is, even if it just brings us back to where we were 3 years ago, if it clears the deck so we can have an intelligent conversation about what has to come next, I'll be happy with that.
And I think if you look, if you pull back the curtain on behind trade, you'll see a number of other areas that are sort of bubbling up and need to be addressed. And I would argue that if we can address this in some way, it will provide us some momentum, at least to look at those other areas. And the opposite is indeed true. If you can't address the trade, how are you going to address the other issues in the
relationship? Right. And we have to recognize that there are a lot of issues that are important to us in America that are going to be really, really difficult, if not impossible, to resolve without China's help. Climate change, for example. China is about a third of global CO2 emissions. How do we deal with terrorism, with non-proliferation? How do we deal with North Korea and Iran without assistance from China? And can I also add one more point? You mentioned currency. I think there is a bit of a mythology now that the currency is a real problem for us in the United States. I think let's look at the numbers. Since the tariff dispute started, which I date back to March 22nd of 2018, the Chinese currency, the renminbi, has devalued by about 10%. But that's, in my view, simply a reaction to the strength of the U.S. dollar. The dollar index, the DXY, is up about 9% compared to the 10% fall. This is what's driving it. It's not a competitive devaluation. Year to date this year, the dollar's up about 2% and the renminbi is down 2%. So I don't see any evidence that they are deliberately manipulating the currency to gain an unfair trading advantage with us.
Well, these are really useful insights, and really want to thank you for joining the China in the World podcast, but also thank you for spending the week at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Let's hope we can get you back.
It's been a great program. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining the China in the World podcast. Be sure to check out more content from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center on our website.